This episode is brought to you by B2G Global Strategies, for whom I proudly serve as CEO. B2G is an international security and investigations firm whose clients include some of the leading individuals and companies around the world. Our services include forensic accounting, anti-money laundering, cyber investigations, due diligence investigations, and security and threat assessments. You can learn more at b2gstrategies.com. At the beginning of this season, I noted that I bring an unusual set of skills and interests to bear upon the true crime podcast space. I am a historian by training and am the author of a book about revolutionary violence in the Middle East. I taught at UCLA and at Occidental College for a brief period after receiving my doctorate, and then left academia to work as an intelligence analyst for a security and investigations firm. My boss, under whom I apprenticed, was the former head of the FBI's counterterrorism division in Los Angeles. When he moved on from the firm, I promoted up to CEO. The upshot is that I have examined crime from the upper rungs of the ivory tower and engaged directly with it at the level of the street. The McDonald murders have been scrutinized by journalists like Joe McGinnis, Janet Malcolm, and Fred Bost, novelists like Jerry Allen Potter, and private investigators turned documentary filmmakers like Errol Morris. All have made valuable contributions to the case, some more than others, as the past seven episodes demonstrate. I would like now to examine this case as a historian. As I concluded in the last episode, legally speaking, Jeffrey McDonald should not be in prison. One cannot honestly examine the government's case against McDonald and conclude that it proved his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That simply isn't true. Having acknowledged that, however, we need also to acknowledge the obvious. In many cases where all but one occupant of a home is murdered, the lone survivor is the murderer, something the murderer will typically deny. It is a disturbing fact about us humans. The threats that haunt our imaginations come from afar, but the ones that actually materialize often do so under our noses. Many victims of violence are attacked by people they know. Many victims of rape are assaulted by people they know. And many murder victims take their last breath staring at the back or into the spiteful eyes of someone they know. The serpent that doomed Eden did not have to breach its walls. It arose from within. This is Matthew Craig Kelly. Welcome back to The Looking Glass.
And the wheel of destiny has turned. The survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamina.
Five, four.
The great four, silent three, majority.
Castle. Drive.
Dustin Morgan composed the music and sound design for this episode. Our cast this episode features Nick Wheeler as Dennis Eisman, Lily Heller as Pamela Kalin, Randall Dudley as Captain Clifford Sommers, Nancy LaScala as Winnie Casper, Jay Hughley as Lieutenant Edwin Casper, Joshua Hensley as Colonel Warren Rock, and Tony Peterson as John Chester. A special thank you to Shoshana Pearson and Angela Shelton for connecting us with several of these brilliant actors. You can follow us on Facebook at The Looking Glass True Crime Podcast and on Instagram at TheLookingGlass_podcast. We will be posting Season 1 related documents, photographs, and short essays regularly at both of these accounts. If you enjoy the podcast, please tell your friends. We appreciate your support. So if we knew nothing else about the McDonald murders, the fact that Jeffrey McDonald survived them would place him near the top of our list of suspects. Well, what else do we know? What other information do we have about these murders? We need to gather all that information together, and then, as historians, we need to weight it. How do we do that? We do it by subjecting the information to criteria of authenticity. For example, all things being equal, if a proposition is multiply attested, we grant it more weight than if it is singly attested. If two statements from the same individual contradict one another, the earlier statement is, again, all things being equal, more likely accurate. Criteria like these are not foolproof. Reality is too complex for that. But they do, particularly when brought together with competent analysis of physical evidence, give us a framework within which we can, given enough data, come to a reasonably confident conclusion about a historical episode. Let's now approach the McDonald murders as such an episode. What do we want to know? What is the object of our investigation? We want to know what happened at 544 Castle Drive on the night of February 16, 17, 1970. In light of that aim, our first order of business is to consult the testimony of anyone close enough to that location on that night that they may have seen or heard something of evidentiary value. And as we sift through this evidence, we want to note when these individuals were originally interviewed, how close in time to the murders, and to pay special attention to the testimony of those persons nearest to the crime in both time and space. If we take ourselves back in time and place ourselves in the shoes of the investigators originally tasked with determining what really happened that awful night in February 1970, we might be initially optimistic. After all, 544 Castle Drive was hardly isolated. Not only were there other residences nearby, but there was a unit directly adjacent to the McDonald's, which had a second story that was directly above the McDonald's. So let's start there. Did anyone in this adjacent unit hear noises coming from the McDonald's residence that night? The Kalins. The family who lived in the other half of the duplex at 542 Castle Drive were the Kalins. Donald, a chief warrant officer, Violet, his wife, and Vicky and Pamela, the couple's two daughters, both of whom babysat for the McDonald's. The CID interviewed the Kalins in the days after the murders, but the records of those interviews are unavailable, and the Army, for some reason, did not submit them into evidence at the Article 32. Both Donald and Pamela Kalin testified at the Article 32. Pamela's bedroom was directly above the McDonald's living room. At times of quiet, she would sometimes hear voices coming from the unit below. On July 14, 1970, 5 months after the murders, Pamela testified that she had, in fact, heard something coming from the McDonald's residence on the night of the murders. She had gone to bed at about 10:30 p.m. and was awakened sometime during the night by a voice coming from below. As she recalled it, "I believe it was Captain McDonald, and he was either sort of laughing or a sobbing cry." When asked about the volume of McDonald's voice, she remembered it being somewhere in between a scream and a normal conversation, apparently not too loud, but loud enough to disrupt her sleep. There was a critical moment during Pamela Kalin's Article 32 testimony where something that should have been made clear wasn't. Seeking clarification on when, approximately, Pamela heard the voice from downstairs, Bernie Siegel's assistant, Dennis Eisman, asked her,
"Do you know approximately what time it was that you heard the laughing or sobbing?"
"No, I don't."
"Do you have any idea in relation to the time you heard the MPs at the door?"
It was somewhere in between 3 and 4.
"Did you hear any screaming that night?"
"Nope."
Did Pamela mean to communicate that she heard McDonald crying, or maybe laughing, between 3 and 4 in the morning? Or that she heard the MPs knocking on McDonald's front door between 3 and 4. If she correctly heard Eisman's question, she would have meant that she heard McDonald during that hour. But it seems plausible that Pamela, who was a teenager, took Eisman to be asking when she heard the MPs knocking, and that was between 3 and 4 a.m. We have evidence to support this supposition from an interview the CID conducted with Pamela the following year, during which she related, again, that she had heard McDonald's voice prior to falling into a deep sleep, and that he appeared to be in conversation with someone. The author of the CID report indicated that Pamela also heard a second voice, which she took to be male, and which she knew was not Colette's. Here is a good opportunity to apply a historical criterion. We have the same witness, but her memory appears to have changed. She originally testified to hearing one voice. Now we have her hearing two. We should grant more weight to the earlier claim, but we should also note that the two claims do not, strictly speaking, contradict one another. That is, if she heard two voices, then she also heard one. In addition, if she went to bed at about 10:30 p.m., it would make sense that she would be asleep, but not deeply asleep, an hour or so later. If McDonald's voice awakened her, perhaps it did so around 11:30 p.m. or midnight. According to McDonald's story, he was watching Johnny Carson at that time, sitting next to Colette on the living room couch, right beneath Pamela. He might have laughed, as Pamela suggested, and if she heard another male voice, it may well have been Johnny Carson's. 4 days before Pamela did, her father, Donald Kalin, testified at the Article 32. He had gone to bed around the same time as Pamela on the night of the murders, between 10 and 10:30 p.m., but unlike his daughter, he heard no noises coming from the adjoining unit. It was only when the MPs started banging on the door that Mr. Kalin woke up. He was a sound sleeper, however, and while he hadn't heard anything, both his wife and daughter had, and they discussed with him what they had heard. Army prosecutors objected to his offering any details of those conversations during his testimony, however, and Colonel Rock sustained the objection. Unfortunately, Mr. Kalin's wife, Violet, never testified at the Article 32, or if she did, no record appears to have survived. Our first record of what Violet Kalin heard on the night of February 16th, 17th, 1970 comes from February 9th, 1971, a year after the murders, when a CID investigator interviewed her in Heidelberg, West Germany, where Donald had, by then, been transferred. Here is the key passage from the CID interview with Violet Kalin in 1971. I then asked Mrs. Kalin to give me her memory of the night of 16-17 February 70. She reported that she went to bed with her husband about 2200 or 2230 hours on the 16th. Sometime in the night, she woke up to the sound of Mrs. McDonald's voice raised in anger, and she heard what seemed to be an angry rhetorical question. Mrs. Kalin could not hear the words, merely the voice tones, as if Colette was saying, "What in the hell do you think you are doing?" or "Do you think I am going to stand here and take this?" Mrs. Kalin emphasized that she could not hear the words, and that the two above sentences were merely examples of how the tone pattern sounded to her. She heard Mrs. McDonald shout or scream that one sentence or phrase, heard no other sound, and fell back to sleep. As she fell back to sleep, Mrs. Kalin stated to me, it occurred to her, "My God, Colette is stabbing Jeff or the children." Here I interrupted Mrs. Kalin to ask her what provoked this thought of a stabbing. Had she seen or heard anything previously that would have substantiated this thought? Mrs. Kalin told me it was just a thought that flashed across her mind and she did not know why it came to her. She had no grounds for the impression. Mrs. Kalin reported that she went back to sleep and did not awaken until the military police came to the McDonald home and began knocking on the doors. If the listener has gained the impression that Mrs. Kalin was, perhaps, a bit eccentric, the listener is right. She didn't hear a single word Colette said, but it sounded like, "What in the hell do you think you are doing?" or "Do you think I'm going to stand here and take this?" Okay. She had the thought, "Colette is stabbing everyone." And then she went back to sleep? Okay. It is difficult to resist the conclusion that, in the year that elapsed between her original interview with the CID and this later one, Mrs. Kalin developed a few ideas about what happened that night in February 1970. It would therefore be helpful to know what she said back in February 1970, well before the Army revealed that McDonald was their chief suspect and at a time when most people assumed that intruders had murdered Colette and the children. The earlier statement, which regrettably we do not have, would likely give us a more accurate understanding of what Mrs. Kalin actually heard that night. We can speculate. Let us assume, for the moment, that Mrs. Kalin did hear something that night and ask what she might have added in retrospect, having developed the suspicion that McDonald was the murderer. Let's then subtract those additional details and see what we are left with. We will want to subtract the words Mrs. Kalin heard but didn't hear, and we will want to subtract her reported impression that Colette was stabbing people. What is left? She heard Colette's voice raised in anger. She heard Colette's voice, but not Jeffrey's. Let's mark that down. Incidentally, should the listener have any doubts about Mrs. Kalin's eccentricity and, shall we say, imaginativeness, she went on to tell the CID investigator that a few months before the murders, a bleeding Jeffrey McDonald had materialized before her with a knife in his hand. It was an apparition, a terrifying vision, and she was mentioning it now only reluctantly. As luck would have it, there was another clairvoyant in the neighborhood, Mrs. Rosalie Edwards, who lived with her husband on the other side of the Kalins from the McDonald's. She told the CID that Mrs. Kalin was crazy, but then volunteered that she herself had twice dreamt of Colette since the murders. The CID agent reported, "In the first dream, which took place about 3 days after the tragedy, she saw Colette in the backyard of her home, her long blonde hair flowing in the wind. In the dream, she asked Colette who had killed her, and Colette answered that it was the people up the street. The second dream involving Colette occurred about 4 months ago. Again, she saw Colette in the backyard. This time she asked Colette who had killed her, and Colette answered something to the effect, "They are all gone now. They have talked to the wrong people." Mrs. Edwards had previously not reported these dreams to anyone but her husband. She places great faith in her dreams, and reports that in her life she has had about 5 dreams concerning her late father, and that in each case what he had said had turned out to be worthwhile and of value to her family. Well, we are in the position in which all open-minded historians find themselves when they stumble upon the bizarre, the uncanny, or the unlikely. For the skeptical listener who is thinking of David Hume right now, just know that Hume's argument against miracles, while still quite popular among self-styled skeptics, does not go through. Check out John Ehrman's Hume's Abject Failure if you doubt me. So we at least need to leave the door open to the possibility that Mrs. Kalin and Mrs. Edwards, like Sarah Palmer in Twin Peaks, saw things. But I confess that my instinct is the same as yours. It appears that the two women fancied themselves seers, which makes them problematic sources of information about a historical event such as this one. One last thing about the Kalins. The author of the CID reports on the family noted more than once that the Kalins owned a dog, which would reliably bark when anyone approached the apartment. But no one could remember the dog barking that night, not until the MPs arrived early in the morning. This may have been because no one approached the building that night. Or perhaps the dog did bark but did not awaken anyone. It is, after all, hard to believe that the slaughter occurring in the adjacent unit was a quiet affair, and only Mrs. Kalin appears to have been awakened by any part of it. If the family slept through that, they may also have slept through the dog's barking. Finally, it was raining that night, which would have added a layer of ambient and potentially obscuring noise to whatever other sounds there were. Let's consult the eyes and ears of others in the vicinity of 544 Castle Drive that night. The Caspers. On August 10, 1970, First Lieutenant Edwin Casper and his wife, Winnie, testified at the Article 32. At the time of the murders, 6 months earlier, they were living at 334 North Doherty Drive, which was a half block, a little less than 500 feet, as the crow flies, from the McDonald's. Peering from their windows, the Caspers could see the back entrance of 544 Castle Drive. On the night of the murders, the couple were home with their 2 children. Mrs. Casper testified that she went to bed that evening sometime between 11:30 p.m. and midnight, and awoke at 3:45 a.m. to help her 2-year-old daughter go to the bathroom. She remembered the time because she had looked at the clock. But Mrs. Casper had also been awakened before then by the sound of people laughing and scuffling outside her window. She was only aware of the noise momentarily, and might have attributed it to a dream, had her husband not asked her the following evening if she had heard people outside the window the night before. He had heard them too. When the Army prosecutor, Captain Somers, asked Mrs. Casper whether she had heard the voices closer to 11:30 p.m. or 3:45 a.m., she replied,
"It was closer to 3:45. It was not 11:45. It was closer to that time because I had been in bed, quite a while, and was just drifting off to sleep, and I heard this. And it was definitely not 11:45.
For obvious reasons, Somers sought to cast doubt on Mrs. Casper's testimony. She and her husband had been interviewed by 2 CID agents on February 17th, the day of the murders. Somers now asked her,
"You did, in fact, then speak to 2 CID people?"
"Yes, I did."
"If I were to tell you that you told these people that you went to bed at 10:30, would you say that's impossible?"
"That I went to bed at 10:30?
"Yes."
"Oh, gee, no, that's impossible."
"You couldn't have told them that?"
"No, because I remember watching the weather very definitely."
"If I were to tell you that you told these people that you heard footsteps running at some time between 7 and 9:30 in the evening, would you say that that is impossible?"
"Yes, I would. Very definitely, yes."
"Then you did not tell them either of those things. Is that correct?"
"I certainly did not."
A moment later, Captain Somers asked,
"Miss Casper, did the CID speak to your husband at the time they spoke to you?"
"Yes. Yes, they spoke to both of us. We were eating dinner, and they came."
"Did you hear what your husband told them?"
"Did I hear? I suppose I did. At the time, I don't remember what he said." We were both there, and I was with the children back cleaning the table off and that sort of thing. I couldn't tell you exactly what he told them. No.
To the best of your knowledge, was what he told them similar to what you told them?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, yes. I don't know exactly. I couldn't tell you exactly word for word what he said.
What time did your husband go to bed that evening?
Early, as I remember. I think maybe 10.
Would you repeat that answer, please?
I think 10. I really don't know. You will have to ask him. I really don't know. He went to bed before me.
Could he have told the CID that he went to bed at 10:30?
Yes, he could have, yes.
Could he have told the CID that he heard this running and footsteps between 7 and 9:30 that evening?
As I remember, he did say that. As I remember, I think he did say that.
He did?
And then he said, I say, well, I probably don't remember what I did say. Anyway, I told him that was impossible because he didn't go to bed until 10. And it was around 10, he says, I'm going to bed. And I said, well, I'm going to watch the weather and the news, and I'll be to bed.
Edwin Casper's memory of that night comported with his wife's. When asked, were you awakened at any time during the night of 16-17 February after you had gone to bed? Mr. Casper replied,
yes, sir.
Approximately when was that?
I would say anywhere from... if I went to bed between 10 and 11, I would say between 12 or 2400 hours and 0300 hours.
Why were you awakened?
I heard what I thought was the next door neighbor's kids running up the path, and the splashing of the feet in the water woke me. And I just rolled over, didn't think anything, and went back to sleep. But my wife said, you know, later on when the CID agent came by and asked me if we'd heard anything unusual, I mentioned this. And I said, of course, it was the kids next door. My wife said, no, they had already moved. So then I didn't know who it could have been.
Colonel Rock pressed Mr. Casper on the matter of what he had told the CID agents who interviewed him on the evening of February 17th.
Do you remember whether you indicated to the CID agents approximately what time you thought you heard those noises?
I think I did. I think they asked me about that.
Do you recall your reply?
No, not really. I don't know. I can't remember what I said.
All right. Do you think, Lieutenant Casper, that your recollection of the events that evening is fresher now in your memory than it was on the date of 17th of February?
No, sir. It's not fresher because it's been a while. And I just, you know, I just try to... And the only thing I can remember is that they woke me up. And I usually go to bed between 10:30, between 10, 11, and that's all. Exactly what time they came by, I think it was between 2400 and 0300 because I was able to go back to sleep. If it had been like 4 or 5 in the morning, I'd be up because I'd have to get up at about 5:30 or 6. I probably went back to sleep, so that's all I can remember.
As he did with Mrs. Casper, Captain Somers insinuated that Mr. Casper had earlier given a different answer to the question about when he'd heard the noises outside his window.
When you were interviewed by the people you described as CID agents, could you have told them that you heard this at a period of time between 7:30 and 9 in the evening?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I'm telling... You know, remember what all the questions were and what I remember saying. I might have. I thought that I heard it earlier when I was downstairs reading the paper because that's when I was downstairs reading the paper. Now, either I don't know. I can't remember what I really said.
It's possible, then, that you might have said between 7:30 and 9.
Right, but I don't know for sure because I was awoken that night also between approximately 2400 hours and 0300 because I remember I went to bed and I was awoken.
When pressed, the one thing Mr. Casper was willing to state with certainty was that the sounds had woken him up. They could not, in that case, have occurred between 7 and 9:30 p.m. Through his questions, Captain Somers insinuated that the Caspers had originally told CID investigators that they had heard the voices during the earlier time frame. But there was something conspicuous about Somers' questioning. Two things, in fact. First, Somers did not introduce the report of the CID agent's interview with the Caspers into evidence. How strange. Had the report been lost? Or, perhaps, did the report not state what Captain Somers was insinuating, but never stating outright it did? The second conspicuous fact about Somers' line of inquiry was the manner in which he consistently phrased his key questions. He kept posing them as hypotheticals. If I were to tell you, would you say that was impossible? Could Mr. Casper have told the CID? Could you have told them? It certainly appears that Captain Somers, for some reason, did not want to state on the record that the Caspers were contradicting their earlier testimony. But what about the fact that the Caspers themselves remembered Mr. Casper telling the CID agents that he had heard the noises between 7 and 9:30 p.m.? One thing to notice is that neither Mr. nor Mrs. Casper volunteered this information. Both remembered it only after Captain Somers suggested the idea to them. We are in speculative territory here, but the research of Elizabeth Loftus, one of the most influential figures in the field of psychology over the last half century, has demonstrated that humans are highly suggestible when it comes to memory, and that a key proof of this fact is the extent to which people remember fabrications, that is, acquire false memories, if the fabrications are planted in their minds by a trusted authority, such as a therapist, or, in this case, an army prosecutor. Is that what happened here? Without the record of the original CID interview, we cannot say. But note one other thing, bearing Loftus's research in mind. Mrs. Casper, even when Captain Somers suggested to her that she had told the CID agents she'd heard the voices between 7 and 9:30 p.m., adamantly, immediately, and categorically denied it. I certainly did not. A few more details. Mrs. Casper recalled that the voices were heading in the direction of 544 Castle Drive. Mr. Casper recalled hearing the voices on two occasions, about 30 minutes apart. At first, they were heading away from Castle Drive, and then he heard them moving back toward it. The couple's testimonies thus diverge slightly on this point, but note what is multiply attested. The voices outside the window were heading, at one point, in the direction of 544 Castle Drive. Mrs. Casper claimed to have discerned the voices of at least two men and one woman. Mr. Casper could not definitively corroborate this claim. He did take the voices to be both male and female, but thought this may have been because he assumed the voices were those of the next-door neighbor's girl and two of her friends that were boys. Unbeknownst to him, these individuals had moved. Mr. Casper thus warned that his preconception may have colored his half-conscious impression. Be that as it may, we have one Casper claiming definitively to have heard at least two male voices and one female voice, and the other Casper affirming that memory, albeit with a qualification. A qualification, we should note, that adds credibility to Mr. Casper as a witness. This was clearly a man who was aware of the complexities of memory, and who certainly rode no hobby horse into the Article 32. To all appearances, he was doing his best to honestly recall the events of February 16th and 17th, and when the chips were down, he planted his flag on the fact that he had been awakened very late at night by the sounds outside his window. In summary, what should we make of the Casper's Article 32 testimony? Given the lack of any documentary evidence contradicting it, and the suspiciously qualified manner in which Captain Somers suggested that such documentation might exist, the weight of the evidence points to the Caspers having been awakened by a small group of men and at least one woman, laughing and scuffling outside their window in the rain as the group walked in the direction of 544 Castle Drive sometime around the time when the McDonalds were murdered less than 500 feet away. In other words, the Caspers' testimony constitutes circumstantial evidence corroborating Jeffrey McDonald's story. The Pendley Shocks. We should also recall the testimony of Mrs. Janice Pendley Shock, whose bedroom was a stone's throw from Jeffrey and Colette's. She told the CID that her dog's barking had briefly awakened her sometime during the night of February 16th and 17th, and she had heard something. A woman was screaming in the distance, and children, she was certain it had been more than one, were crying, all at the same time. Was this the same voice that Violet Kalin had heard, that of Colette McDonald? Mrs. Kalin did not recall having heard the voices of children, but note what both she and Mrs. Pendleyshock also did not hear, the voice of a man. One thought that occurs to me is that if Janice Pendleyshock heard a woman and children screaming in the night, and she was a mere 50 feet from where a woman and children were being murdered, she was probably hearing the murder. The evidence that Mrs. Kalin heard the raised and apparently angry voice of Colette McDonald is even stronger, as she was even closer to the McDonald's residence and knew Colette's voice well. Why Mrs. Kalin did not hear children is an interesting question, but it is important to remember that both women, Mrs. Kalin and Mrs. Pendleyshock, were awakened briefly in the night by these sounds, only to swiftly fall back asleep. Their impressions of what they heard were faint, that is. Why did neither woman hear the voice of a man? On the government's theory, the violence had begun with an intense argument between Jeffrey and Colette. If what Mrs. Kalin and Mrs. Pendleyshock heard was Colette crying out in fear, anger, or both, it appears that her attacker was not himself also yelling, as he might have were he in a blind, murderous rage triggered by an argument with Colette. If Colette's killer, or killers, had come from outside her home, he, or they, were almost certainly alert to the importance of evading detection by not yelling and screaming. For the same reason, incidentally, they would likely not have turned the apartment inside out by smashing china and creating a lot of noise. Who else in the vicinity heard or saw something on the night of the murders? The witnesses we have consulted thus far are ones we would be foolish to disregard. They were people who lived in the immediate vicinity of the crime and from whom the authorities sought information near enough in time to the crime that their memories should not have entirely faded or been hopelessly tainted by subsequent developments. There were other people who lived in the area and who claimed to have seen or heard suspicious things that night, but we need to acknowledge up front that these other witnesses may fall into a category that will be familiar to anyone who has studied a high-profile crime: attention seekers. They may not. It is, frankly, difficult to tell. The attention seeker is a well-known and somewhat disturbing type. To take perhaps the most obvious historical example, how many people have claimed, over the years, to have shot John F. Kennedy? Back in the 1960s, when New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison created a media frenzy by announcing to the world that he had cracked the Kennedy assassination and would shortly bring Kennedy's killers to justice, the attention seekers descended on the city from all sides. They had shot Kennedy. They had met the people who shot Kennedy. They had seen Oswald and Jack Ruby together before the assassination. The stories were endless, and they all seemed to reflect the same sad tendency. These were people who just wanted to be part of history. If that meant being universally reviled for having killed an American president, it was a price they were willing to pay just to be known, to be significant. It's a topic for another podcast, but I would argue that the same was true of Kennedy's actual assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was absolutely determined to force his way into the history books. There are, I suspect, a number of such persons who have sought to attach themselves to the McDonald murders over the years, and one way for us not to get entangled in their kooky stories is to simply observe a cutoff. If you came forward in 1983 to say you'd participated in the murders, absent some compelling reason not to, we are going to dismiss your story out of hand. The people we will now be looking at may have been exaggerating their own importance or seizing on the murders to sneak into the limelight, but they were around and talking at the time of the murders themselves. The listener will decide what weight to give their testimonies. The Chesters and Mrs. Snyder. Besides the Pendleyshocks, the Kalins, and the Caspers, others of the McDonald's neighbors wound up testifying before the Article 32. A particularly noteworthy pair of witnesses were John and Susan Chester of 305 Castle Drive. Around lunchtime on the afternoon of the murders, the Chesters were visited by their next-door neighbor, Jan Snyder. Mrs. Snyder was in an excited state. Word of the murders had started to spread, and she had, she said, seen something suspicious the night before. According to both Mr. and Mrs. Chester, Mrs. Snyder told them that early on the morning of February 17th, sometime between 3 and 4 a.m., she detected the hum of a car engine outside her building. She'd considered it unusual enough that she'd gone to see who it was. Peering from her second-story window, Mrs. Snyder claimed to have spotted a convertible idling in the street, and, running down the sidewalk towards the car from the direction of 544 Castle Drive, a woman with long hair. The woman got into the car, which then drove off. Mrs. Chester remembered Mrs. Snyder saying that the woman's hair was long and blonde. Mr. Chester only remembered her saying it was long. According to both Chesters, Mrs. Snyder told a number of other neighbors the same story. Mr. Chester had himself been present on some of these occasions. The defense had some difficulty tracking Mrs. Snyder down, but they ultimately succeeded, and she did end up testifying at the Article 32. There, she denied having ever told anyone that she had seen a woman in the early morning hours of February 17th. In fact, she couldn't remember saying anything to her neighbors about that night. She did recall waking in the early morning hours of February 17th and hearing a car outside. She also remembered looking out her window and seeing a car retreating into the distance. She could see its taillights, but little else. Bernie Siegel asked Mrs. Snyder whether she was, by chance, afraid for her life. She answered no. He asked this because of another incident that the Chesters related at the hearing. Mr. Chester claimed that, a few days after the murders, Mrs. Snyder started banging on the wall separating their two apartments. When Mr. Chester asked her what was wrong, Mrs. Snyder told him that there was a man outside the apartment building pointing a gun at the second floor, where both the Snyders and the Chesters lived. Mr. Chester claimed to have then looked out the window, and lo and behold, there were two men sitting in a car, one of whom was aiming a high-powered rifle at the second-floor apartments. Mr. Chester raced to grab his shotgun, but when he returned to the window with it, the car with the two men was pulling away from the apartment building. One reasonable inference, Siegel suggested, was that, to put it colloquially, Mrs. Snyder's big mouth had gotten her into trouble. Someone involved in the crime had gotten wind of the fact that Mrs. Snyder was running around telling everyone she had seen a car and a woman and so forth. It is tempting to dismiss all this, as Army prosecutors insisted Colonel Rock do, but there are a few details that strike me as potentially significant. First, the Chesters appear to be credible witnesses, and they give us a multiply attested scenario in which Mrs. Snyder told them and others that she had seen a car and a woman with long hair running from the direction of 544 Castle Drive at around the time of the murders. Both Chesters appeared to be somewhat skeptical of Mrs. Snyder's claims, and there was a faint sense that they took her to be a loquacious and perhaps not totally reliable woman. In fact, Mr. Chester testified that he had encouraged his wife not to report Mrs. Snyder's comments to the authorities because they were little more than hearsay and likely had no relevance to the murders. In other words, the Chesters themselves did not seem to be seeking attention, but rather to be simply answering the questions asked of them. By contrast, and second, Mrs. Snyder's testimony was odd. Not only did she not recall seeing anything but a car on the morning of February 17th, but she did not recall speaking to anyone about what she had seen. Yet, if Mrs. Snyder was like most human beings, the morning of the 17th would have been an especially memorable one, given that it was the morning when she learned that a woman and two young children had been brutally murdered just down the street. Everyone would have been talking about it. And only 6 months later, few people would have forgotten having talked about it. Of course, one obvious explanation for Mrs. Snyder's lapse of memory was that the Chesters were right. She was an attention seeker who had been running around gossiping in exaggerated detail about what she had seen that morning. In that case, she may have been embarrassed by her behavior when called to testify, and therefore may have trimmed her story back down to size while claiming never to have said anything different. But what about the man with the gun? We earlier spoke of the limitations of lie detection, even for professional interrogators. Despite that, investigators have learned a few tricks over the years, which controlled studies indicate are dependable guides to determining when a person is being dishonest. Perhaps not surprisingly, given what we learned in Episode 7, one of the more reliable of these techniques does not depend on scrutinizing the affect of the speaker, their tone, or their physical behaviors. This technique can be applied without seeing or hearing a speaker at all, in fact. The theory is that if a person is making an event up, their description will feature less detail and more repetition of detail than if they were recalling a real event. Remembering, after all, is less labor-intensive than fabricating. Think of how much easier it is to recount a real event than it is to imagine, in vivid detail, one that never occurred. And now, bearing this criterion in mind, listen to the way Mr. Chester answers the probing, quick-fire questions of Captain Somers, which are clearly designed to undermine Chester's credibility. The context, again, is Mr. Chester's claim regarding the man with the gun outside his apartment building.
Now, you've described this rifle as a high-powered. What was its caliber?
I have no idea.
Then why you describe it as a high-powered?
It was bigger than a .22, so that makes it high-powered.
How could you tell it's bigger than a .22?
The thickness of the barrel, the weight of the stock, the fact that it had a telescopic sight with a light ocular lens on it.
Is it possible to have a thick barrel and still have a small caliber weapon?
On a target rifle, yes. This was not a target rifle.
And how do you know that?
Small scope. It wasn't fitted with the accoutrements of a target rifle.
I see. But isn't it possible to have a rifle specially built, or the stock of a rifle specially built?
Anything is possible, but this was a standard rifle.
Mm-hmm. Well then, what make was it? What model?
I have no idea.
Then, how do you know it was a standard rifle?
It had a small swivel forearm, like a Model 70 Winchester would have, for instance. It wasn't a sniper rifle, nor was it a custom-made rifle, because the bluing on it was the standard job that didn't shine in the sunlight. It was a newly finished rifle.
It certainly appears that Mr. Chester was calling upon an actual memory, and therefore that the incident with the gun-wielding man was real. It was also multiply attested. Although she denied banging on the wall, Mrs. Snyder herself affirmed that she had seen the man with the gun. Years later, in 1980, Mrs. Snyder would tell the investigator Ted Gunderson that she had, as Siegel suggested, censored herself at the Article 32 because she was in fear for her life. Unfortunately, Mrs. Snyder said a whole lot more than that, some of it demonstrably false. Her credibility is therefore shot, and it would be a mistake to take her word for anything. But when we pare Mrs. Snyder's statements down to what she originally told people and to those claims that are multiply attested, there may be a historical core hidden beneath the fictions. She may, in fact, have heard and seen a car driving away from the area of 544 Castle Drive at around the time the murders occurred. And while Mrs. Snyder denied blabbing to the neighbors, it appears likely that she did, just as the Chesters, who were more credible witnesses than she, testified under oath. This does render the incident with the gun curious, at the least. It is certainly odd that, only days after the McDonald murders, a man sat outside a neighboring Castle Drive apartment complex, aiming a high-powered rifle directly at its second story. The scenario seems more compatible with someone attempting to intimidate or even kill one of the residents than it does with someone being so oblivious to the collectively frayed nerves of the neighborhood that they would run the risk of appearing like they were trying to intimidate or kill one of the residents. We have now considered what I would regard as the core credible testimony about the night of the crimes. As noted, there were plenty of other people who claimed to have seen or heard something important and relevant on the night of the murders, but their testimony emerged sometimes years after the fact, rendering it dubious from a historical perspective. I have left one exception to the side, however, because it features prominently in every evaluation of the case and warrants its own episode. We will consider it next time on The Looking Glass.